Perek Ches. Okay, so there's a whole chunk here. The prophecy begins, Perek Ches Pasuk Aleph, and it goes all the way to the end of Perek Yud Aleph. So we're now going to do the last Perek of this long prophecy. Okay, the prophecy begins. Look, if you go back to Perek Ches, it says, it was in the sixth year, in the sixth month, the fifth of the month. Now, sixth year, well, again, sixth month, we know all the months in the Torah or in Tanakh are always from Nisan. So we have Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul. So Elul, in fact, it's very interesting. The Ramban points out it's kind of an anomaly. We're the only people in the world who celebrate the beginning of our year in the Chodesh HaShvi'i, in the seventh month. A little odd. Why are you still celebrating the beginning of the year in the seventh month? And yet, insofar as the Torah is concerned, all the months always begin from Nisan. Rosh Hashanah happens to be in the seventh month. In other words, it's the seventh month from Nisan. It happens to be the beginning of the year because that is when Adam HaRishon was created. But in terms of the Jewish New Year, the Jewish New Year really begins in Nisan. So this was a prophecy, once again, that took place, that came to him the fifth day of the month of Elul in the sixth year. Now, once again, what is this sixth year? It doesn't say sixth year of what. But this is the sixth year from the Golus, from the exile of King Jehoiachin. Remember the idea that there were 11 years between the exile of Jehoiachin and the Churban, the destruction of the temple. And during those 11 years, the learned classes are in Bavel, and there is kind of a residue of Dalat Ha'aretz, of impoverished people who live in Eretz Yisrael. And Yecheskel is in the Gola, is in Bavel, and this is the sixth year, meaning it is 5 years before the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Okay, that is the setting. The setting tells us, once again, he is sitting in his home in Bavel, surrounded by people who are called Ziknei Yehuda. Ziknei Yehuda means the elders of Yehuda. Now, obviously, it doesn't mean they're the elders who are currently living in Yehuda, because he's in Bavel. But it means these were people who had been leaders and elders of the exile. And then if you recall, I just want to go over the steps here so you get a sense of the whole idea of the prophecy once again. And while he's sitting, he gets into a trance. He gets pulled by his hair to Yerushalayim. And he sees the various scenes of degradation and evil that occur in the temple. Right? Remember, he sees... Right, this is all described in Perek Ches. He sees an idol. He sees women crying in front of a statue. He sees a subterranean chamber of the 70 elders of the Sanhedrin who are bowing down to all sorts of cave drawings on the walls. And finally, he sees 25 people who expose themselves to the Beis HaMikdash. They're facing the sun and their backs are towards the west. And he sees all this. So Perek Ches shows us the visions that he has of the evil and the sin that exist in the temple. And as we explained, it is not only the external temple, but primarily the internal evil that is with them, is that's what he sees. Perek Tes, Yecheskel is still in Yerushalayim, and he has a vision of God authorizing six angels of destruction to go through the city and not have mercy and kill. Again, as we said last week, this refers primarily to the concept that Hashem is decreeing a destruction in the heavenly Yerushalayim. And therefore, even if it hadn't happened yet, in effect, it's a dead city, because whatever happens up there, this world is just a reflection of what happens there. And this is where we had the very famous scene where there's an angel that's a recording angel, and he was told to put a mark on the foreheads of the tzaddikim. And they should have been saved, but ultimately they were not saved because they failed to give rebuke and musar to the Rishayim. And even though it wouldn't have helped, but as the Malachim said to Hashem, how did they know it wouldn't help? They have an obligation to do whatever you can to fight something that is evil. So that is described in Perek Tes. Then we have Perek Yud. Again, this is all one long prophecy. In Perek Yud, we have the vision of the Merkava of God's celestial chariots that is retreating from the Beis HaMikdash. It leaves the Holy of Holies, and then it goes to the door of the temple, and then it goes into Yerushalayim, and then it finally goes on the Mount of Olives before it departs in Shemayim. So this is the image Yechezkel has of the Shekhinah gradually departing from the Beis HaMikdash. Remember, this is 5 years before the Churban, but there's this sense that God's presence has already left. So this is where we're up to at this point. And Yechezkel prophetically still finds himself, either in his mind's eye or somehow physically, his soul was transported in Yerushalayim. And Perek Yud Aleph, again, is just literally continuing this prophecy once again. And it says, Hashem brings him back to the east gate of the temple, and he sees 25 men, and among those men are two people who are called Ya'azniah ben Azor and Pelatyo ben Benayahu. Now, here, it's interesting because it's a little confusing. We already did have a reference to something about 25 men. If you go back to Perek Tes, the last thing that he saw in the Beis HaMikdash were 25 men who were facing the sun. They were bowing towards the sun. Their backs were towards the Beis HaMikdash. They exposed themselves in the direction of the Beis HaMikdash. And that's what he saw. Now, it didn't give anybody's name. Now, here it also mentions 25 people. And it mentions two of their names. But it doesn't say anything. It doesn't say anything about them. Are these the same 25 people or are they different? So many Mefarshim learn that these are the same 25 people. And here we're, in fact, given their names. But it doesn't say they're doing anything. It just says they were there. So the concept is this. It's almost as if what Hashem is trying to tell the Navi is that those 25 people that you saw doing a repulsive thing before, they weren't actually doing it. I showed you a physical manifestation of the evil in their heart. It's almost as if, for a second, I gave you the ability to look into their minds. And that's what you saw. And you saw that ugliness. And then I take away the picture. And all you see are 25 regular people.
And what do you say? So they were only thinking about doing evil.
Yes. Well, or they did evil secretly or whatever it is. In other words, the evil that was described was the evil that was in their hearts. Oh. It did not refer to what they did. And that's why it's almost as if, for a second he had this picture of what they really were like inside. And then the picture shuts off, and all he sees is Sarei Ha'am. Sarei Ha'am means he sees princes, nobility, leaders. Nothing wrong. And Yechezkel is almost a bit confused. Are these the same people I was just looking at a few moments ago? I mean, they weren't doing that before, or what they're doing before, they're not doing now. Now, it does mention their names, though, and it is a little confusing. We know nothing about these two people, Yazniah ben Azor and Pelatyo ben Benayahu. They are described as Sarei Ha'am. They are described as leaders of the people. Now, Yazniyahu, as a name, was mentioned before, but not Yazniyahu ben Azor. If you go back to Perek Ches, and this was the scene of, this is Pasuk Yud Aleph. This was the scene of the subterranean chamber in the temple where 70 elders were worshipping creeping idols, shrutzim, little creeping animals that were painted on the wall. And it says there were 70 people from the elders of Israel. Yazniyahu ben Shafan omeid b'solchem. Yazniyahu ben Shafan was there. Now again, we know nothing about Yazniyahu ben Shafan, just as we know nothing about Yazniyahu ben Azor. One would have to, since Yazniyahu is not a common name, one is tempted to assume that this is the same person, although why is he sometimes called the son of Azor and sometimes the son of Shafan? It's not really clear. Shafan is the name of a non-kosher animal. Perhaps it's a name that was attached to him as a sign of God's disgust with him. He called him Ben Shafan. But also, The problem is, if it's the same fellow, he's in the wrong group. In other words, in the image that we saw in Perek Ches, we had this image of the 70 elders under the subterranean chamber worshipping idols. Then we had the 25 people who exposed themselves, and Yasniyahu was put with the group of 70 in Perek Ches, and here in Perek Yud Aleph, he's put with the group of 25, so it's not the same grouping. But again, if we imagine this not to be simultaneous actual occurrences that people are doing, but the evil that lurked in their heart, you could have overlapping membership. It could very well be that the 70 people he saw under the temple were, a lot of them were the same 25 people there. The fact that he saw them like at the same time doesn't mean they couldn't be the same people, because all of these are just visions in his mind that Hashem is showing him about the corruption that exists. Now, again, the significance of the names really escapes us, but one can imagine the fact that Yechezkel recorded this. I mean, after all, there were 25 people or 70 people. Yechezkel probably knew a lot of their names. These are people he knew. But he recorded this because presumably this totally shocked him. I mean, imagine the shock at seeing somebody who was well-known, probably known as a righteous person, to see all this. And this was such a shock to him that he just, and he was in there too. And in fact, we will see specifically the second person that's mentioned, Pelatyo ben Benayahu, who we know nothing about. Yechezkel has an image of him being killed. And that made him cry. He says, he asked Hashem, I can't believe this. How could you kill him? So apparently, Pelatyahu especially was known as a great tzaddik. And Yechezkel was in a state of shock that God's judgment should be executed against him. Okay, but again, there is this question, Yasniyahu. I mean, the only two places in Tanakh, I believe, where the name Yasniyahu is mentioned is here and in Perek Ches, and it's not entirely clear that it is the same person because there's a different father's name that is attached.
Is this, do we envision that Yechezkel told people this prophecy in these words that we're reading?
No. That's a very interesting point generally. There is a difference between the Torah and Nevi'im and Ksuvim. Yechezkel had a prophecy of Hashem, and Hashem, would presumably tell him to write it down, but then he would write it down in his own words. Hashem would not tell Yechezkel the exact words to write down.
Right. But what I'm wondering is, so do we imagine that, say, these names were mentioned in front of the people to whom he was relating this?
Not automatically so. If you look at the end of Perek Yud Aleph, though, it does say, Perek Yud Aleph, the one we're doing today, it does say in the last verse, Perek Pasuk Chafei, Vo'adaber el Hagola, I spoke to the exiles, Es kol divrei Hashem asher herani, all the words of God that he showed me. Again, that seems to suggest everything that he records, he recounted. But again, by definition, there has to be some notion of selectivity. I mean, there are many things he may have seen that he didn't necessarily tell, but so we don't know. But I imagine, though, that the tenor of this prophecy would be such that this would be a detail he'd want to reveal. Because remember, keep in mind who his audience is. On one hand, he's describing the corruption in Jerusalem, but he's not addressing his prophecy. Mm-hmm. Remember, this is a prophecy he's addressing to the Gola, and he's telling them, don't think that that Beis HaMikdash there is going to protect you. That temple is destroyed. Those people are going to be destroyed. It is your responsibility to do tshuva and continue the Jewish people. So I think it would be very telling that he would point out that those people that you might think of as the great leaders in Jerusalem still, they're not.
Right. But is the implication here that Lashon Hara of this type would be acceptable then in an extreme case like this?
Well, absolutely. Lashon Hara is acceptable. If someone is, I mean, it's difficult because there's always a problem of how do you make the right judgment. But if somebody is taken to be a gadol and a leader of the Jewish people, and you know that he is a great sinner and people should not follow him, there is a mitzvah to expose him. Now, the very big risk, of course, is that because people have their own subjective standards, what makes somebody treif, and then, of course, you have Chil Hashem, for me to say, oh, this guy's a Zionist, and therefore, that's a separate thing. But where somebody is obviously a Russia and an evildoer, and again, and you can't say Yechezkel is speculating, he has shown this with a divine prophecy, then it's not Lashon Hara. There is a mitzvah to protect people from following a person that is a corrupt leader.
Now, is he showing that the war is happening, or while it's
happening? As I'm saying, part of this is nothing's happening. In other words, in effect, he is showing them what type of people they are and what they're capable of doing. It's not clear at all. It's not clear if he's showing him something that is happening, something that will happen, something that did happen, or something that could happen, even if it actually didn't happen at all. Because the Beis HaMikdash is used as a metaphor for the holiness of the Jewish heart, and he's saying, this is what is in their hearts. I mean, you're correct. It's not clear that we can historically identify these things as actual occurrences. And this is why Hashem switches. In fact, the very fact that he shows them the same 25 people doing something and not doing something suggests that this is an imaginary image of what they're capable of doing.
You might have discussed this, but when does the Navi receive these visions? Is it in the dream statements? Or?
Yeah. This is the chiluk. This is what the Torah says. If you remember when Aaron and Miriam spoke Lashon Hara about Moshe. We're going to read it in a few weeks. And basically, they criticized Moshe. He was not with his wife, whatever it is. So Hashem, you know, struck Miriam with leprosy and said, Moshe is different than all other prophets. All other prophets, I come to them in dreams and visions. And Moshe is fully awake, and I can talk to him. And prophecies are generally swoons. Yechezkel is sitting at the table. He's not asleep at night. He's sitting at the table. And prophecy comes to him, and there's kind of a loss of consciousness. And he's in a trance-like state. And that's when he has the dream. No, not sleeping. No. In other words, a Navi can get prophecy in the daytime, but a Navi attains prophecy only when he's in a state of, he's not really here. Only Moshe had a level of prophecy in which he was able to be fully awake and fully aware, and even able to go through his business. He could shut it off. He could kind of, you know, pay the bills and go back to prophecy. It was that type of thing. It wasn't an all or nothing, total trance-like state. Yeah.
At what point does the community have the ability to distinguish between Mesira, you know, let's say they know that a leader is doing something wrong,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, being obligated to...
Well, it's very, very difficult, and because of that, the decision should normally not be made by the regular members of the community. It should be made by other gedolim in the generation. Now, in our generation, things are very tough because we do have gedolim who disagree over things, where one gadol will say to another gadol, "You're no good," and vice versa. That's a very, very difficult situation. I won't say it's unprecedented. Certainly, with Chassidim and Misnagdim, we had very, very strong fights as well. But it's a difficult situation. Generally speaking, though, in the course of one's life, one develops a concept of who is your Rebbe, who is your leader, who is the one you look to for guidance in this matter. And that is the person you'll follow. But it's a hard situation. And Yechezkel was much easier, in a sense, because Yechezkel was a Navi. And Hashem gave him a message. So, you know, there's no Lashon Hara concept here. When we have to make our own judgments, it's even if a Gadol has to make a judgment, it's a much more difficult situation. I mean, obviously, Lubavitch would be the thing that would come to one's mind with Rav Shach and Lubavitch Rebbe.
These days, virtually every Gadol is affiliated with an institution. And there's so much going on politically and monetarily. And,
yeah.
You know, in New York, you hear these scandals coming up all the time. And how does
Well, yeah, but a lot of the scandals don't directly implicate Gedolim. I mean, there might be individual institutions, etc.
But
yeah.
Still community leaders.
I think, too, there's also an idea that the Gemara says a Talmud Chacham is somebody who creates peace in the world. And if there's too much divisiveness that somebody's generating, I think there's a basis for a little suspicion. Talmud Chacham should be somebody who creates shalom, as the Gemara says. All right.
Taking these two, though, it's not maybe Lashon Hara, but it's shaming them in public. And that's...
That's necessary. I mean, the problem is that if it's one thing, if these were not leaders, right, if these were just private individuals, but these are people that who are looked to as role models and people would follow them, and
so
it was necessary. It's necessary to expose it, so that otherwise people will continue. But apparently, with Pilatiyahu, there is an argument in the Gemara. Some say that the fact that Yechezkel was so shocked, even after he saw Pilatiyahu in this group, the fact that he'll be so shocked when Pilatiyahu dies, some say Pilatiyahu was in fact a tzaddik. And this gets us into a whole complicated issue, the Holocaust and other things.
Mm-hmm.
The concept is, there's a Gemara. Gemara says, Rashi quotes it, Mishimitna Rishus Lamashchis, when the power of destruction is given authority to kill, Eino Mavchin Bein Tzaddikim L'Rishayim, it does not differentiate between the righteous and the evildoers. In other words, there are forces that are unleashed in which even the righteous die. Of course, we saw this because part of the reason the righteous died was because they didn't properly oppose the evil around them. So in effect, that means there's a dimension in them that was not totally righteous because they didn't do what they could do. But there's also a concept that it's very complicated theologically, and not everybody would agree with it, that evil, to some degree, is an autonomous force, which God can, of course, rein in, and God can stop, but if God chooses not to stop it, it can just do things. In other words, the analogy would be, there are germs all around us, right? There are germs all around you. In fact, people ask the question, how come if you get your feet wet, you get a cold? Like, how does lowering your temperature make you sick? It doesn't really make you sick, but the concept is this. The truth is, we're surrounded by germs all the time. But normally, our body can protect us. Now, when you get cold and you need more of your energy to be involved in keeping your temperature, so therefore, it's less is used for your resistance. So what makes you sick is not getting your feet wet. What makes you sick is you're surrounded by everything and you lose your protection against it. You lose your immunity against it, or a reduced immunity. So some perceive of evil in the world in the sense of God protects us at various times, and really most times, but when there are times when Hashem decides to conceal His presence and He removes the protective immunity, so therefore we could be open to all sorts of destructive forces. But it's not that God decrees the destructive force, it's that the removal of protection allows things to happen, and if that allows things to happen, then even tzaddikim could suffer. I mean, that's one view. Now, many reject that. Many say that everything, every last event, is orchestrated and mandated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for reasons that we don't know, certainly. That's the mystery of Eve. Why do righteous people suffer?
Mm-hmm.
But you can't just say, it's not that Hashem decrees it. It's just Hashem just lets it happen. Some say you can't say that. But there is an argument, and certainly... by any type of korban, we always see the specter of righteous people who suffer. And the ultimate answer is, we don't know. This is, the Gemara says in Brachos, when Moshe asked Hashem, show me your glory, hareini na'as kvodecha, he wanted to know, why do tzaddikim suffer? Why do Rishoyim prosper? And Hashem says, I'm not going to tell you that. That's the 50th level. We talk about 50 levels in understanding God. It says, Moshe Rabbeinu understood 49 levels. The 50th level would have been this. And he couldn't understand. Eev couldn't understand, right? We mentioned before that all Hashem tells Eev is, you don't even know how a mountain goat gives birth, so you don't ask me this question. He shows Eev a travelogue about the wonders of nature. He says, you don't know. You don't know anything. You don't know how a snake lays its eggs. You don't know, so don't ask questions about this. When you figure out how ants build their... this is all in Eve, it's really discussed. Just how ants build their nests or whatever, then you can talk about higher questions. Again, there are many, many Mishalim, but ultimately we believe there's some type of purpose involved. But apparently, what's interesting is that Yechezkel expresses, though, he's not just the cool, collected recorder of what he sees, but he reacts in shock when he sees this person. He says, I can't be. And when he sees this person get killed, he says, that can't be. How can he die? Because he has kind of a human reaction to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes.
The person who did not
No, we're talking about evil within the Jewish community. That's it, very much so. Okay, now again, I wasn't addressing why there was a Holocaust. Here in Yechezkel, the destruction of the temple and the was described because of an evil within the people. With the Holocaust, you know, we honestly, it's without a prophet telling us, we cannot offer any definitive explanation. Certainly, there was a tremendous evil from outside, obviously, and nobody told Hitler to go ahead and kill the Jewish people. And God gives freedom of choice. And part of the reason why evil things happen is if God gives us the choice to do good, that also means we have the choice to do evil. If you don't have the choice, then you don't have the choice. So one can look at this as the inevitable byproduct of God giving us choice.
But that choice might not have been that they had failed to do something within the community.
Not necessarily. Oh, okay. That could very well. I mean, that. In other words, what you're saying, you're raising the question: do Jews have a duty to oppose evil that is outside of the Jewish? Yes, I think that's so. I think that's very much the case. That the obligation to protest the evil is not limited to evil within the Jewish community. It would apply to outside as well. Absolutely. In fact, Maimonides writes that Jews have an obligation to ensure. Or to try to ensure that non-Jews obey the seven commandments of Noah, which are the basic tenets of morality.
So that alone might have meant.
Well, I don't want to tie it into the Holocaust per se, but if you're asking, are Jewish people accountable for tolerating evil outside of their community? The answer is yes, there is. But I can't tie it into a specific.
Because maybe they had been completely righteous within the community, but those.
Well, it is, your point is correct. It clearly is an aveira for which people are accountable. Now, whether we could tie it into that specific thing, I don't want to do. But
this first one.
Yes, that is correct.
They may have been completely.
Well, here though, Yechezkel clearly describes that within the Jewish community there was also sin. I mean, there was sin within and without. And also keep in mind that in this context, Jews were not living in a mixed society. They were living in their own land, in their own country. There was less relationship to non-Jews in terms of dealing with them. It wasn't like today when we're already in exile. But the Gemara does say one of the reasons why Jews were put in exile is to be an influence on the rest of the world. In fact, the Gemara even says Jews were put into exile in order that we should get a lot of converts. But that doesn't mean, but apparently, that doesn't mean that people should convert to Judaism, because we discourage converts. But presumably it means they should become converted to the ways of Noahide law, Noahide morality. The Lubavitcher Rebbe had a campaign to encourage public school kids to learn the precepts, the seven Noahide laws, which, you know, makes sense. I mean, the truth is, the Jewish community has not been involved in that for a long time because we're so, you know, there's so many Jews who don't keep their own Torah, etc. And we don't yet have our own ranks that good. But in an ultimate sense, Jews are supposed to be emissaries to the world. And that's why it's so awesome. I mean, the truth is, when people say, is Israel held to a double standard and everything else? Of course it is. And maybe, you know, we don't want the Umos HaOlam to do that to us, but the truth is we do have to hold ourselves to it. Holding ourselves to a double standard is entirely appropriate. To say, well, Syria did this, so we can do that too, because they do worse. That's not a teretz. They do what they do, but that doesn't define our conduct. Nachum Sherman writes, he used to be a principal of a day school, so when he used to tell the kids they were misbehaving, they said, how could you say that? You know, the teachers come in after teaching a public school and they say they love coming here. There are no knives, no guns, no drugs. So he says, that's how you define yourself. You know, as you say, if we don't have a gun, we're good. You know, you have to try for a higher standard than that. I don't know if I mentioned the PIA. This is just a classic survey to tell you what the public schools have become, where 30 or 40 years ago there was a survey of problems in public schools. And the worst problem was spitballs and talking. And then they did it 40 years later, and you know, it was guns, drug, and rape. I mean, it's a difference in 30 or 40 years. Okay. All right. All right. See, if you look at Pasuk Beis, when Hashem shows him the 25 people, you see that this indicates that if they're the same 25, that must have been an imaginary vision, because he says, Ben Adam, Eloh ha'anashim ha'choshvim oven. These are people whose thoughts are evil. It's not their actions, their thoughts are evil. Hayoetzim atzas ra. And they are giving bad advice. Be'ir hazos. This concept of giving bad advice, this is taken very seriously. In the Yom Kippur Vidui, in Oshamnu, right? The Oshamnu, what is the Yod? Yo'atz nira. We have given evil counsel. That's taken very seriously. Now, of course, evil counsel is not the same as wrong counsel. In other words, of course, we give advice, we ask our opinion, we make a mistake. But yo'atz nira is when you give advice that is deliberately given, not for the benefit of that person, but for your own self-aggrandizement. That's a very, very serious aveira. And in fact, according to Rashi, the verse in the Chumash that we read last Shabbos, the Shabbos before last, the famous verse, Lifnei iver lo sitein michshol. In front of a blind person, you don't put a stumbling block. Rashi says you don't give a person advice that is injurious to them for your own immediate benefit. This applies in even mundane contexts. Let's assume you're a salesman and your job is to sell that life insurance policy or sell something to somebody and you know they don't need it. It's a prohibition of the Torah to encourage people to buy things that they don't really need. That's a violation of Lifnei Iver. So salesmanship and everything else can raise problems. And he calls them, these are Yoetzim Ra. Ha'omrim, what do these people say? Lo bikarov benos batim. Okay, this is a hard verse to translate. Alo bekarov means not in the near future build houses. So there are a few ways of reading this verse. One is lo bekarov. The destruction is not in the near future. We have a long way to wait. Therefore, benos batim. Let us continue to build our houses in Jerusalem. These leaders tell their people, don't worry about it. We'll be in Yerushalayim forever. That's one way of reading it. And there's lo bikarov, meaning the churban shall be lo bikarov. Therefore, benos batim, let us build houses in Jerusalem. Others say that Hashem is tracking the words of Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu told the exiled community, build houses in Babylon, because you'll be here for the long haul. So according to that reading, they're saying, Lo bikarov benos batim. There will be no reason to build houses in Babylon for a very long time because we'll be here in Yerushalayim. So, but the meaning is the same. They're telling people, we're safe. But then they use a very strange phrase. And the way they describe their safety is, Hi hasir. Yerushalayim is a cauldron. A pot. Va'anachnu habasar. And we are the meat. Now, that doesn't sound really like a description of safety that much. It's a little strange. I mean, the Mefarshim say, what they mean to say is, just like a pot protects the meat in it from being burnt, so we are protected. But it's a very odd way. I mean, it's still not an image of security. I mean, the meat's going to get hot. So which means they seem to be saying, you know, things are going to get hot around here, but we'll be okay. Well, yeah. But the point is, they're using this as you know, kind of a good statement about themselves. But it seems to be a very mixed. And maybe that's the concept that they're trying to convey a positive image of hope to people. But they really know in their minds that it isn't as good as they make it sound. But that's what they say. We are, Yerushalayim is the pot and we are the meat.
So the councilmen are saying that.
These are the leaders, right? And Hashem is saying, this is called atzasra. This is called an evil counsel. Because by giving people a false sense of security, They don't do tshuva. Again, this is, we've discussed this before, this is the concept of looking at the Beis HaMikdash in a magical sense rather than a spiritual sense. In a magical sense, you look at things like superstitious rites. As long as we have the temple, as long as we do steps 1, 2, 3, and 4, we have our safety policy. In reality, the Beis HaMikdash is a spiritual idea in terms of holiness and the way you live your life. And these leaders are communicating to them, just follow the steps, follow the ritual, and you will be protected. And Hashem tells them, tells Yechezkel, that this is not true. He talks about, you have made many dead bodies in this city, which means not... This is a double remiss. Number one, murder was a rampant crime during this time. But also what he's saying is, all the people that are going to die in this city will be because of these leaders who have prevented the people from doing tshuva. And then he says, you won't even have the satisfaction of being in the pot. Which means, a person might say, all right, at least I'll die in Jerusalem. He says, you won't die in Jerusalem, you'll be taken from Jerusalem, and you'll be killed outside the city. You won't even have the satisfaction of being cooked in that cauldron.
And what was happening during this time to the Kohen Gadol when he went to Kodesh and Kodesh Yom? Did they die?
No, the Kohen of Gadolim, at least some of them, were still largely righteous. In fact, the Kohen Gadol, who was serving at this time, was the father of Ezra.
So there wasn't that moral leadership.
There were some. Well, we see this, because remember, the Malachim were told to write a mark on the Tzaddikim in Yerushalayim. So they were Tzaddikim, presumably, as Chazal say, they didn't were not active enough in opposing the evil that was done. But apparently, even though the Choresh and the Masker, the Talmidei Chachamim, were exiled 11 years earlier, there must have been some spiritual leadership. The Kohen Gadol was still here, for example. Yirmiyahu was in Yerushalayim during this time. Remember, Yirmiyahu is the prophet who directs his words towards the people living in Israel. Yechezkel is the prophet who was having visions of those people, but he's directing his message to the exile. So there were some. Once again, it was not enough to stop this. The steps,
did you know,
yeah. They knew each other. They were both Kohanim. It's interesting enough. Yirmiyahu was a Kohen. Yechezkel was a Kohen. Yechezkel was a Kohen. That's right.
But did they have visions?
Yirmiyahu? Sure.
Yirmiyahu had visions.
Yeah, there's a whole book of Yirmiyahu. Sure.
Right. So, but they were different in that.
Well, Yirmiyahu, okay, let's put it this way. First of all, Yirmiyahu's prophecies began much earlier. Yirmiyahu had visions before the first exile.
Oh, right.
So Yirmiyahu was still prophesying at a time when the Churban could have been averted. Yechezkel does not talk about averting the Churban, if you think about it. Yechezkel, in fact, you'll see as the rest of the paragraph become even clearer. Yechezkel's message is to the Gola, telling them the temple is already lost. Mm. Maybe it'll hang around for another 5 years. It'll be gone, and your job in Golos is to recreate the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. So they have different messages. Yirmiyahu's prophecy was to call on the people to do those things that would prevent this exile from occurring. Now, the whole concept of exile, the whole concept of Golos, I mean, obviously it's part and parcel of the rhythm of Jewish history, that we have periods of destruction, redemption, destruction, exile, redemption, we go back and forth. Now the pendulum has been going very, very long in the direction of Golos and Churban. The beginning of the State of Israel could be said to be a partial moving of the pendulum back, but then it doesn't go back very fast. It goes back very slowly, as it were. You have Golos, and then it swings back a little bit, and then it stays still almost for years, and then it inches forward every time, and then you have little setbacks. So it's not a symmetrical pendulum that goes at the same way in one direction and the other. And why there's Golos again is part of the collective mystery of righteous people suffering and everything else. But according to Chazal, the truth of the matter is very interesting. We were supposed to be in Mitzrayim for 400 years, and we're only in Mitzrayim for 210 years. And therefore, we never completed that process that was necessary for the rectification of the soul. And all the Golus is really carrying out. Mm-hmm. We just could have held out another 190 more years, which
we
couldn't.
Would have been better.
We wouldn't have needed all the Golus that we need. But it is a process of refinement. And on an emotional level, the concept is that, just as the Gemara says, the Baal Tshuva is greater than the perfect righteous person. Mm-hmm. And that is because the Baal Tshuva knew what it means to be distant from God. And therefore, there is a greater love for Hashem in that person's heart because they know what it's like to be far. And Golus, part of Golus is to kindle within us a burning desire for HaKadosh Baruch Hu by having a sense of distance and separation from Him. Now, the problem of Golus is, though, that as Golus gets longer and longer, and particularly when life gets comfortable, the burning desire to be close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, have a Beis HaMikdash, is something that you lose that desire as well. You forget about it. And that's why it is said that the deepest level of Golus is when a person does not feel that they're in exile. Because when you feel that you're in exile, then in a sense, you're halfway there. You're achieving a redemption by a sense of exile. When there's no sense of exile, then you're truly in exile, because there's no force within you that wants to be close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Which is why many people have pointed out over the years that the Golus of a comfortable society is a much more difficult on spiritual level than a Golus of a persecuting society. You mentioned Rabbi Tzurevi likes to say it's harder to be Jewish in suburbia than Siberia. He says in Siberia, you'll always know you're Jewish. In suburbia, it's a little more difficult. And even those of us who are Shomer Shabbos, it's an equal Messiah. Rav Shimshon Feld Hirsch once remarked, he was talking about 19th century Germany, he said, what's the difference between Muranos and us? He says, the Muranos were the Jews in Spain who openly practiced Christianity because of fear for their lives, and they worshiped Hashem privately. He says, the Muranos, he says, were Jewish inside and Goyim on the outside. He says, sometimes we're Jewish on the outside, we might be Goyim on the inside. So even if somebody keeps all the mitzvot externally, but is there a true passion and desire to be connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? It's a foreign idea. It's a foreign idea because our mitzvah observance becomes very external, and that's an occupational hazard for especially from people who have so much to do. So this is a big problem. We have so many things we have to do that very often we're not able to concentrate on the internal dimension of being what it means to be a spiritual, religious person. It's a problem. It's a very
The person that davens so, has been davening all along, the kavona sometimes, it just goes
quickly. That's right. The Rambam says that originally tefillah was in a person's own words. Every person would pray to Hashem in their own words. Then later, when people became less capable, so it says that we have stylized, ritualized prayers. But on one hand, that's good, because now we know what to say. But on the other hand, there's a loss, because we no longer express our own thoughts to Hashem. And as Nachman Breslov or other people say, you shouldn't lose the other way, too. That, you pray from a sitter, but one should talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in their own words. All the great tzaddikim, the Chafetz Chaim, people used to hear the Chafetz Chaim talk to Hashem in Yiddish. We even have prayers from Rav Levi Yitzchak Berditchover, things like that. So it's something that people should have. And the rest of our Hasidus, they talk about every person every day should have a place where he or she goes in isolation. Be a forest or something where they just talk to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem withdraws, but once He withdraws, things can even happen to the righteous.
Is that the only reason?
No, it's not the only reason. Chait is one reason. There's also a concept in the Gemara called afflictions of love, Yisurin Shel Ava, where Hashem wants to give us more reward by creating difficult circumstances, which if we withstand, makes us more deserving of Hashem's love. There is that concept as well. There's also a concept, if you ever read Viktor Frankl's book, Logotherapy, Man's Search for Meaning, Man's Search for Himself, I don't remember which one it was called, but Viktor Frankl was a Jewish physician who was in Auschwitz. He was not religious, but he wrote about the ability of human beings to become very noble through the difficulties they were in, people who were just regular people. But this gave them the capacity to become virtuous. Now, let's assume Hashem wants to create a world where we become as virtuous as we can become. In other words, we become the most generous, the most kind, the most compassionate. Sometimes those qualities can only be developed in the most difficult situation. In other words, a person does not know what kindness they're capable of doing unless they're starving and they give their bread to a child. The potential for evil in a personal, right, that goes back to the choice. So there has to be an Auschwitz if there are to be people who will develop the holiness that is within them. I mean, it's a complicated idea because, you can, well, but aren't there so many people who are suffering? But somehow, this is the only way that Hashem can create a world in which you... you will not, you want to be the pot, you want to be in the pot, you will not be in the pot, etc. Okay. Now look at Pasuk Yud Gimel, that's the reference that I referred to. When as he is talking, as Hashem is talking, he sees Pelatyahu ben Benoya die. And this shocked Yechezkel. Now apparently, why did it shock Yechezkel? Either because this Pelatyahu was a great tzaddik, and he just sees him die, and he falls on his face, Yechezkel does, and he calls out and he says, God, are you going to destroy everybody? If this man goes, who can possibly be left? Apparently, Yechezkel thought of this person, again, we know nothing about him, but he thought of this person so extraordinarily high that he said, if he goes, there can be nobody left. There's no Jew, he felt, that is as worthy as this Jew. And why did he die? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu then tells him, because there's no one in Eretz Yisrael at this point who is worthy of leading the Jewish people, and the focus must move from Eretz Yisrael to the Golos. And he says, this was a false dependence on what was going on in Yerushalayim. And he says, Ben Adam, Achecha, Achecha, your brethren, Anshe Geula Secha. Now here the word Geula Secha is very interesting because really it doesn't fit. It should really say Anshe Golu Secha, the people of your exile. But he calls them Geula Secha, the people of your redemption, because what he's saying is redemption shall come from them, from those who are with you. The people that perhaps you look down upon because they were exiles. But they are the ones who will bring your redemption. And look at this, we have an example of snobbery. Asher amru lahem yoshvei Yerushalayim. On those very people that the inhabitants of Jerusalem said, Rachaku me'al Hashem, they have been distanced from God. Lanu hi nitna haaretz l'marasha, the land has been given to us. This is really the first time I think you see this attitude. You see that ironically, although the first wave of exiles were generally considered to be the spiritual elites, but we find that the people in Yerushalayim looked down upon the exiles by saying, God kicked you out because you were not worthy. Mm-hmm. And we stayed because we're more worthy than you. And now Hashem is telling Yechezkel, no. Those Anshei Yerushalayim that said, Lanu Ha'aretz, the land is ours, and you are unworthy, they shall be destroyed. And the exiled people will build up the community. Now, you can really see, though, it's very, very interesting because the people who remained in Yerushalayim were largely not the Torah scholars. So what they kind of did was they saw the exile of the first wave as a confirmation of their disrespect for those who were learned in Torah. And they basically said, Hashem kicked you out because you're not worthy. And we stayed. But of course, that was not the case. You know, as I mentioned, Mordechai, as we know, was one of the people who was exiled in the first wave. And here we have the famous verse, which we use today. Tell them, ki hirchaktim bagoyim, even though I have thrown you far among the nations, v'chi hafitzosim ba'aretzot, I have scattered you among the lands, v'ahi lohem l'mikdash ma'at, I shall be for them a miniature temple in all of the lands that they go. The phrase mikdash ma'at, the Gemara tells us, refers to the concept of a beis hakneses, of a shul, that a shul is called a mikdash ma'at. It's taken from this verse in Yechezkel, that Hashem is saying, you know, the beis hamikdash can travel with you. It's not the whole, it's not the beis hamikdash. It's a mikdash ma'at. It's a little bit of a beis hamikdash. And in fact, many of the laws of a shul are connected to the laws of reverence in the beis hamikdash. For example, you know, you're not allowed to use a shul as a shortcut. Let's assume, again, it doesn't apply to hallways, but let's assume all you had was a shul. You didn't have a hallway or things like that. And my car was over there, I wanted to go through the two, we don't have two doors, but I want to go through one door to the other side instead of walking around the building. The law is you're not allowed to walk through a shul to use as a shortcut. You must go around the whole building. Even if, for example, there's a phone call and I want to go into the shul to call you to the phone, I'm not supposed to do that unless I sit down for at least a few seconds and recite a pasuk. You're not supposed to enter a shul unless you say a prayer or learn something, because it's not covered to a shul. If it's raining outside, you're not allowed to go into a shul to get shelter from the rain. Now again, the way our shuls are built, all shuls have vestibules and the like, so you could do that. But, you know, in the old shuls, all there was one big room. Mm-hmm. If all there is one big room, you could not enter a shul to escape the rain. Same thing is true for a base medrash. The difference of a base hakneses is a place where mainly you daven. A base medrash is where you learn and you daven. A base medrash is actually higher in sanctity than a base hakneses, because a base medrash you also have Talmud Torah. You're not allowed to eat in the shul. Now, that raises a lot of problems, but under the strict letter of halacha, one is not allowed to eat food in a shul. So how do we have
kiddush? On the place you daven.
Well, if you have a social hall, that's not a problem. Yeah, you can certainly.
Right. Who eats in front of the aron?
Who eats in front of the aron? We just had a bar mitzvah yesterday. Who eats in front of the aron? We certainly do. All right, so there is a question. So there is a din like this. There is a law in the Shulchan Aruch that in Chutz La'aretz, only in Chutz La'aretz, not in Eretz Yisrael, which is a big problem, you're allowed to build a shul with a stipulation that we're allowed to eat and drink, at least for religious ceremonies, like a bar mitzvah or a wedding or the like, not stam. But many Meforshim say that only means that when the shul is in ruins, see, the halacha is even when a shul falls in ruins, it has holiness. So you could make a stipulation that when it falls in ruins and it's no longer functional, I could eat. But when it's used as a shul, many meforshim say you cannot make such a stipulation. Now, there is one opinion only that says you could even make a stipulation when the shul is functioning. Mm-hmm. So apparently, the Jewish world seems to follow that one opinion, but it's a minority opinion. It's really not a majority opinion. The custom is widespread, but you know, if we would be starting from square one, one should not eat in the shul. Now, here's an interesting thing, though. In a Beis HaMedrash, you're allowed to eat. Let's say what we're doing now. You're allowed to eat and drink in the course of your learning. If it'll keep, you know, if you're able to learn better by eating and drinking, you're allowed to do that. So you can have a cup of coffee or the like. But to sit down and have a meal in a shul is not proper. And all of this is derived from the fact that a Beis HaKnesses is called a Mikdash Ma'at. It's a miniature Beis HaMikdash. Mm-hmm. And all of these laws certainly existed with respect to, of course, the Beis HaMikdash. You did eat, that's true, but only korbanos.
Korbanos, you said that only one opinion.
It's only one opinion, that's right.
But isn't it a custom in Jewish communities that the way of a community behaves almost, a community can determine that certain things like minhagim?
Well, yeah, but again, if there are questions of minhagim in which there's no preference in halacha one way or the other, so community decides. But here, there's a strong preference. Most opinions in halacha say it is prohibited to eat in the show. There's one opinion that would allow it, so you don't necessarily allow communities to say, we'll reject nine opinions and follow one opinion.
So did the kids eat candy even in those times? And is that?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
The whole
but the kids.
Baby, the bottle, the whole
well, that's another issue. There's an issue, by the way. Should children be young children be brought to shul? There's an interesting discussion about this. You know, it says there's a mitzvah of hakel, which was an outside mitzvah, but it says every 7 years in the Yerushalayim, the year after Shemitah. In fact, it would be this coming Sukkot. Mm-hmm. Everybody's supposed to come to Yerushalayim, and it says men, women, and taf, babies. And they're supposed to hear the melech, the king, read the book of Devarim from a Sefer Torah. And this is one of the mitzvahs where it specifically says, you bring the children, you bring the children. So Rav Nassan Adler points out that this teaches us that when it comes now, and what does it say? It says the men come because they have a mitzvah of learning Torah, the women come to learn the mitzvahs they have to keep, and the children come, it says, to give reward to those who have to take care of them. As Hashem gives them reward for the effort. And Rav Nassan Adler says that you see here that even though you might think Hakel is once every 7 years, a real special experience, why should I bring my four-year-old? I mean, he'll distract me from the sanctity of the moment. That you see that no, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to bring your children to experience this event, even though it'll take away somewhat from your own concentration. What's the 7 years? Okay. But if that's not the one wants to say, huh?
We're not dealing only with the parents of the child, it's what the child does to people.
Yeah, that's right. But if that's not, so Rav Nassan Adler takes the position that even if the davening will be disturbed somewhat, but overall, there's an influence for the child to be in shul is a good thing. The Mishnah Berurah, however, Chafetz Chaim, is actually against it more. He doesn't quote Rav Nassan Adler, but he makes the point, your point, that, you know, it's one thing for the parent to say, I'll give up some of my kavanah for my child. Mm-hmm. What about others? That's so he actually suggests if kids are disruptive, they shouldn't be brought to shul. It's a difficult problem. You know, in cities like Baltimore, you resolve it very easily. On two sides of Park Heights Avenue, if you want a minyan without kids, you can go to the Aguda. If you want a minyan with plenty of kids, you can go across the street to Rabbi Goldberger's, so you have a choice. In Silver Spring, at least in Woodside, we're a little more limited, so we have to kind of accommodate. We don't have other shuls to go to.
What about the problem during diapers?
Yeah, now there's another question.
The food. I was thinking in terms of food.
Okay, all right, there's few. Okay, yeah. Yeah, now the other question is diapers is a very, very serious serious problem. The halacha basically is that you're not allowed to daven in the presence, or at least within... Well, if the odor of a diaper can reach you, you're not allowed to daven. And therefore, parents who... Now, there is a thing, though, that if a baby is only nursing or is only bottle-fed, the excrement would not prohibit you from davening. Once a baby eats solid foods, then there would be such a shiloh. So that's something to be very conscious of and very... Yeah. And therefore, you have to be aware of that. Now, in terms of eating, in terms of feeding a child in shul, nursing, breastfeeding a child in shul, you know, is not necessarily, people do it sometimes, it's not necessarily the proper thing to do, although, if necessary, it can be done in a modest way, but that should be done outside of the shul. In terms of a child eating food, again, a child, nobody should eat food in shul, but all I can say is, if we have bar mitzvahs in a shul, I'm not going to begrudge a child eating a piece of candy. I mean, In other words, if we were to truly observe the halacha against not eating in shul, then indeed kids should not get candy in shul either. But we're making on that. We don't keep that halacha.
But we give kids cookies and stuff to keep them quiet, so help us daven.
So you're arguing it's for the purpose of davening. Okay. That's
like I went to a shul in Denver, which had a room in the back of the Beit HaMikdash. It had a glass window, and the women with babies would go in there, and you wouldn't hear the babies cry, but then they could hear what was going on. And all this was a microphone.
It only worked with a microphone.
There must be. At least they had the separation. How could you have the sound?
Yeah, you really can't have a one-way sound barrier unless you have a microphone.
So
you can have a one-way, view of things. That might be a situation. But Boston Rebbe's mechitza in Boston is a one-way glass, so the women can see out. And
I've seen that before. Yeah. Like partial.
Right. But these are halakhs. So the truth is, we've become so desensitized to the holiness of a shul. It's brought down in halacha. Yeah, this is hard to keep. It's brought down in halacha that one should not show excessive affection to children in shul, because one should only be thinking about Hashem. And that's hard, because on the other hand, there's another factor. If you go back to Rav Nassim Adler's approach, that if children feel that their parents are cold and distant to them in shul, they're not going to want to go to shul. So there is the chinuch idea too that. But the Shulchan Aruch does say one should not kiss children in shul for that. Yeah. I mean, it's mentioned children, I guess, because the assumption is you weren't going to kiss anybody else. But
sometimes you see women coming in and you say, women kiss each other, mazel tov.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah. Okay. But now, and of course, needless to say, talking in shul is, of course. talking in shul is, of course, the very, very big one. And it's interesting. This is very interesting. People don't realize there are two different issues in talking. One is, where are you allowed to talk in davening, which is a davening issue. But forget about davening. Let's say you weren't davening. You're not supposed to talk in a shul, even if you're not davening at all. There is sichas chulin. Just regular conversation should not take place in the shul. And that's, of course, something very, very high level. And during davening, besides that, we have special halachas in many places of davening. You're not allowed to talk. You're not allowed to talk when the Sefer Torah is open. You shouldn't talk when the Aron HaKodesh is open. And then Chazaras HaShatz, you shouldn't talk. Pesukei Dezimra, Baruch Sha'amar, till after Shemoneh Esrei, you're not supposed to talk. I mean, there are very few places you're allowed to talk. And even when you're allowed to talk, you have the laws of Beis HaKnesses that says you shouldn't talk. So Svardim are better than that. Svardim do have, for some reason, a tremendous amount of reverence for synagogue ritual. Even those who don't keep Shabbos. I mean, they may drive the shul and eat non-kosher, but there's a very strong sense that a Beis HaKnesses is a holy place, and they will not say a word in the Beis HaKnesses. That's right. Although many are not observance, but the shuls are always right. Everything in the shul is right. In fact, and all of them know how to daven very well also. Right. That was the thing that they kept, is the Kedushas Beis HaKnesses.
One other question about the rules of the shul. You said that you can't go into a shul for a shelter from the rain.
Right.
Does that mean that a synagogue would not be appropriate, as, let's say, churches are, as a place of refuge for somebody who is in danger?
Yeah, that's a very good point.
That's different than...
Yeah. Well, okay. First of all, keep in mind, when I say shul, I don't mean the entire building. I mean the sanctuary. So certainly, the rooms in the shul, the social hall, the basement, the offices—that's perfectly okay, right? In other words, these laws don't apply to that. Second of all, if there's any danger to life, then for saving of life, we can do anything we want. We can certainly take people in, and even a homeless shul. I mean, theoretically, not that I want to suggest this, but. A shul can be used as a homeless shelter. If there are people who don't have a home, They can come here to have a roof over their heads because they have no place to go. It's not just the inconvenience of getting wet. It's not having a place to go in the winter. So, in fact, in Europe, it was very common for poor people to sleep in the shul. That's where they went. So as someone who doesn't have a place to live can use a shul, and it might be charity to allow him to do so. But we're talking about convenience. You don't use a shul for convenience. You know, if you're going to get pneumonia, then you go into the shul. And of course, if you go into the shul, it is proper to still learn. In other words, you sit down and pray or learn. You don't just use it for that. But all of this, all of these laws are derived from the concept of Mikdash Ma'at. It's interesting that the Gemara says that Rav Yochanan, who lived in Eretz Yisrael, was very surprised when he heard that there were old people in Bavel. How could there be old people in Bavel? The Torah says in Kriya Shema, L'man yirbu yumeichem v'mei b'neichem, you will have a long life, al ha'adama asher nishba Hashem, on the land that God has promised. Rav Yochanan says, how can you live long in Chutz La'aretz? Arichas Yamim should only be in Eretz Yisrael. But then he heard that when he saw that people in Bavel were going early to shul every morning and late at night, he says, in effect, a shul is like an embassy. You know, when you walk into an embassy, you know, the police cannot go on an embassy grounds because the embassy is technically foreign territory. The Israeli embassy is Israel. So in effect, the Mikdash Ma'at, a Beis HaKnesses, is Eretz Yisrael. You're in Eretz Yisrael right now. And therefore, he says, Shayach, by connecting yourself to that, to be in Eretz Yisrael, when you're in a Beis HaKnesses or a Beis HaMedrash. And that's why the Gemara says, La'asid Laval, all of the shuls in Chutz La'aretz will be uprooted and transported to Eretz Yisrael. So that's Kadosh Baruch Hu's promise. Okay. And then he talks about the fact that one day I will bring you back, I will gather you from the nations, I will take you from the lands in which you were scattered, I will give you Admas Yisrael. You will remove the idolaters, the idols there. I will give you a Lev Echad, actually, it's interesting. There are two. If you look in verse 19, it's very interesting. This is one of the rare situations where you have two readings in Tanakh for a verse. V'nasati lahem Lev Echad. I will give you one heart, a united heart. But other people have the text Lev Chadash, a new heart. One emphasizes renewal, and the other emphasizes unity and togetherness. But again, these are two sides of the same coin. There is renewal when there is unity and togetherness. And I will remove, in the famous phrase, the stone heart from your flesh, and I will give you a flesh heart. Yechezkel uses this metaphor very often. He talks about the lev, which is emotion, feeling. And he emphasizes that the heart turns to stone because it doesn't feel anymore. And he says Hashem will replace that with a lev which feels. Again, the nevuah ends with the kruvim, with the cherubs. Remember, the cherubs are carrying God's throne. And they finally go from the temple to Yerushalayim, from Yerushalayim to the mountain that is east of Jerusalem. And we know the mountain that is east of Jerusalem is the Mount of Olives, the Har HaZeisim, and that is the last time Yechezkel sees the Shechina leaving the city. From Har HaZeisim, it goes up to Shemayim. And once it's over the hill, you cannot see it anymore. And that's the end of this prophecy, and all of a sudden Yechezkel comes out of his trance, he is transposed back to Babylon. He's sitting at a table. We don't know how long this whole thing took. Maybe this took 5 seconds, because a dream can be a dream could be an accelerated time. It's not in real time. And he speaks to the Gola everything that Hashem had shown him, these words of reassurance. So that's the nevuah that extends from Perek Ches to the end of Perek Yud Aleph, these five chapters, in which Hashem shows him that any hope in the restoration of the community from the Yerushalayim standpoint is a false hope, and the Gola has to build up itself internally. Okay, maybe we'll stop here. I think the Academy has a the HS Highland.
Yeah. Question about the Gola. When Hashem picks a Navi, you know, one of the Naviim was recorded. Does the Navi have to have a literary ability, or does Hashem, in his gives the ruler, gives the person the ability to...
It's a good question. I don't know. One thing I will say is that the words of the Nevuah are not dictated by God. In other words, this was written, Yechezkel saw pictures and Hashem told him things, and he wrote it in his own words. Now maybe Hashem's words were direct quotes, but everything else, the words he uses to describe the vision are not his words. In fact, that's the difference between Torah and Nevi'im. In the Torah, every word of the Torah is dictation. In Nevi'im, he has mental pictures which he describes in his own lashon. Now, whether this was a pre-existing talent or Hashem had given him the talent, I don't know. I think the Malbim says, in fact, the Barbanel rather says about Yirmiyahu. The Malbim goes crazy at him. The Abarbanel says, why are there so many Kri and Ksivs? In other words, words that are written one way and written another way. So the Abarbanel says Yirmiyahu didn't have literary ability. So he wasn't a good writer. So he makes the point, but the Malbim says, you know, Chas v'Shalom, you can't say that. But the Abarbanel does bring that out sometimes. If there are words that are spelled unusually, he suggests, well, maybe the Navi didn't know how to spell. Okay, have a good week, everybody. We'll see you.